Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing, where the air today is actually pretty darn good for Beijing anyway. So I'm Kaiser Guo, and then joining me, of course, is everyone's favorite irascible South African, the man who puts the cynic in the Cynica podcast, Jeremy Goldcorn. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Kaiser. Suitably medicated, so you can just relax.
I'm glad also to see that you have not succumbed to any upper respiratory ailment.
Not really.
That's just cocaine. Okay.
Well, no, it is not.
I want to ask you just very quickly, what was the best line out of Air Apocalypse 2013 in the media? Did you?
The best piece of reporting or the best?
Oh, whatever. I mean, what was your big takeaway from Air Apocalypse?
I'm kind of tired of Airpocalypse as a catchphrase. I don't know. What I think is interesting about it is watching my fellow members of the chartering classes in Beijing working themselves into
a frenzy
about it and actually enjoying it. Oh. All of us are kind of like, we're hardcore. We live in the city. You know, people actually enjoy it.
my favorite line was Evan Osnos in his New Yorker blog when he wrote, "In Beijing, we talk about air purifiers the way that teenage boys talk about cars." That was good. Anyway, before we introduce our guest today, a quick but vitally important announcement. Next week, we will be recording a special first-ever listener call-in edition of Cynica. Just to be clear, we're not actually having people call in because this is, of course, pre-taped. We'll have regular guest Gadi Epstein of The Economist here with us, and you can direct questions to him, to Jeremy, or to me, or to all three of us to set us a fighting. All you need to do is digitally record your question and whatever, comments, questions, whatever, on whatever app or device you've got handy. Email the audio file, whatever format, to cynica@popupchinese.com. We will try to get through as many of those questions as possible. So please, listeners, do not let us down and leave us dangling with a paltry handful of questions. Details are on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/CynicaPodcast. While you're there, click like. So on with the show. When I first started coming to China in the 1980s, it was difficult to imagine that the country would become predominantly urban as quickly as it did. As you're probably aware, China is now over 50% urban, with an urban population closing now on 700 million, whereas in 1980, we were only talking, 200 million. By 2030, it now looks like China will have 1 billion urban residents, or fully one-eighth of the world's population. There's no topic, I think, that's a better vehicle or lens, or pick your metaphor, for understanding the vast changes that China is under, the enormous challenges it faces. No better vehicle than urbanization. So we are there. I think there's also no better book, or none that I've read yet, than Tom Miller's China's Urban Billion, the story behind the biggest migration in human history. Tom Miller works with Arthur Kroeber and Andrew Batson and some other first-rate China watchers over at GK Dragonomics. And today we are delighted to welcome the author of this brand new book to our show. Great that you could join us, Tom.
It's my pleasure.
Great. So 30 years, nearly 500 million added to the urban population. That's like what this is a book rich with statistics and factoids or factlets that you can throw at people. Combined population of the USA, UK, France, and Italy. I mean, that's just pretty astonishing. But the other one that got me was the built-up city area is now the size of Switzerland.
Switzerland, or if you look at it in a kind of larger way, if you include kind of parks and industrial areas, it's about the same size as Cambodia or Syria.
Oh, those are good sized countries.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Right, sort of a medium sized country.
Well, let's start with a very, very basic question. Why is the Chinese government so intent on urbanization? I mean, what's wrong with having half the country living in the countryside?
Well, actually, I think policy's changed significantly over the last 5 years, or you could say last decade. In the 80s and 90s, the Chinese government had a policy of small town or small city development. Mm-hmm. And it tried to prevent rural migrants from moving into large cities. And apart from special economic zones, that is. But of course, people moved anyway. And so, cities like the big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, Guangzhou, they swelled very, very rapidly, and now Beijing has a population of 20 million or more. And I think that the government recognized, you know, that people were moving anyway, and it had to change its policy. And so over the last decade or so, it's stopped trying to prevent people from moving into larger cities. And in the last 5 years or so, I mean, if you look at the 11th five-year plan, that called for balanced development between cities. And then in the 12th five-year plan, which runs from 2011 to 2015, it actually encourages the growth of very, very large metropolitan areas. And actually, you know, now, under the incoming leadership, urbanization is Mr. Li's big project. And he believes that moving people into cities is really the key to boosting domestic demand. And that means particularly household consumption, because people in cities buy stuff, whereas people in the countryside don't.
Well, people in the cities buy stuff, but I mean, there's a part in your book that actually looks at what exactly it is that they buy, or how much consumption changes actually for recently urbanized ruralites. But let's look first at the topic that you start the book off with, which is of course the one that everyone thinks of when they think of China's urbanization challenges and the big obstacles that it faces, and that is of course hukou reform. Your book identifies quite a number of the big obstacles that it faces, but
let's explain hukou.
That's what I was going to ask him to do actually first. You know, what is this hukou system?
Okay, well, I'll give you a little bit of background first. China's hukou system was introduced in the late 50s, in 1958. And the major reason for that was that the government didn't want millions and millions of migrant workers from the countryside moving into the city and kind of gobbling the food supply. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was the job of farmers to be on the farm growing food. And so that's why it was originally introduced. But of course, it had a secondary use, and that was, you know, of social control. And so that was very, very useful for a communist authoritarian state. So the hukou system essentially divides everybody in China into either a rural citizen or an urban citizen. And it attaches entitlements to different kinds of social security to their hukou status. So, for example, if you live in the countryside and you have a rural hukou, that means that you can go to the local school and you're entitled to very, very basic healthcare in the local county hospital. But if you're an urban citizen, you're entitled to local schooling, which is of a much higher standard normally than it is in the countryside, and you get subsidized healthcare in city hospitals and access to other kinds of social security. So, for example, unemployment benefits and all those kinds of things. So basically, it splits society into two. But over the last sort of 15 years, that's become a little more complicated, because what really matters today is whether not just whether you have an urban hukou or a rural hukou. What matters is whether you have a local urban hukou.
Right.
And this has become the major issue for...
So you could have a Changsha hukou, but that doesn't help you if you're living in Beijing.
Right? That's right. So, I mean, even if you're an urbanite, if you're from Changsha and you move to Beijing, that, you know, that means you will still have to pay extra to go to school, for example, in Beijing.
So what is it that makes it so difficult to simply abolish the thing? I mean, why... We actually hear all these sort of blithe calls all the time. I mean, foreign critics who say, you know, why doesn't China move faster on hukou reform? Why doesn't China?
Not only foreign critics, a lot of domestic critics too, right?
Of course.
Well, I think there are a few reasons, but I think the major one is financial, actually, and that is because local governments are essentially responsible for social security spending in China. So the system changed in the mid to late 90s. When China introduced all sorts of new tax reforms, and it then also handed off control of internal migration to local governments, and so, you know, if local governments had to provide suddenly schooling, healthcare, all sorts of social benefits to millions of extra people, they simply couldn't afford it. If you're a local government and you have a limited budget, say if you're in charge of Beijing, you've got 20 million citizens here, but only 13 or 14 of those are native urbanites, or native Beijingers with Beijing hukou. Mm-hmm. That means suddenly you have to provide for 7 million more people, and that's simply very, very expensive. And I mean, the central government doesn't want to dip into interest pocket and help. So I think, you know, financially, I think the financial issue is the major problem here.
One of the points that you raise is, and I think it's a fair observation. I've not been to India, but we're all familiar with, you know, the massive slums. These beggars with open sores and just crushing poverty. Is it possible for China to really reform its hukou system in a fast way without creating the sorts of slums that you see in India or in large African cities like Lagos?
Johannesburg, my hometown, right, if I may.
Sure.
I don't think China's likely to have the kinds of cankerous slums that, you know, you get in those places. I think one reason for that is China has a very, very different system of government. I think authoritarian
What you're trying to say is the police will go and destroy the slums and arrest the people and drive them out.
Absolutely. Although it does happen elsewhere as well. I mean, I think in India's got a pretty abysmal history of doing the same thing actually at times. Absolutely. But I think they can't move too fast on hukou reform, because if there was a sudden massive influx, then yes, you would have the slums in China would grow very, very quickly too. And it's not true that China doesn't have slums.
Of course,
China does
have slums. They're just not of the sort of
cankerousness,
the level.
Absolutely. But the point is that you know the term slum has become associated, I think, with kind of Bombay, Dhaka, those kinds of, you know, we're talking very slummy slums. You know?
Shanty towns. So, it's cardboard and corrugated
that
iron
sort of thing.
Shacks,
I mean, yeah, there are
right?
different.
That's
yeah,
what
I mean,
we think of when we think of slums.
There are shanty sewers. Towns to a certain extent in China too. I mean, but you know, most of China's slums are really they're called in Chinese
urban villages.
Right, yeah. Right. These are old rural villages which have been swallowed up by the city, now the rural migrants rent out very small rooms which have been often partitioned. You know, they tend to be very, very small.
It's a huge number of these urban villages inside of Beijing, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in Beijing, roughly I think 4 million people live in these cities. In Beijing, but it's hard to know for how long because the government here has a policy of demolishing these urban villages. So in 2010, there are nearly 700 of them. And, you know, I mean, I think this policy is needed. And as China develops, you don't want to have slums in your cities. But, I mean, the big question is, you know, where are these people going to live when they're moved out? And, you know, if people keep on moving into cities and there's nowhere for them to live, then potentially, actually, you will see the growth of bigger, more unpleasant slums than we currently have.
You cite the example of Shijiazhuang, the provincial capital of Hebei province, which of course surrounds Beijing, implemented fairly successful hukou reforms and were able to bring in. But then Zhengzhou, the provincial capital of Henan, tried to follow and with less successful consequences.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Shijiazhuang was actually particularly successful either.
Mm.
But Zhengzhou really struggled. As soon as it liberalized its hukou policy, and this was 10 years ago or so, there was this massive influx of migrant workers, particularly those, you know, sort of living on the outskirts of the city, and it simply couldn't cope, and it had to reverse its reforms pretty sharpish.
Okay, so Beijing has set a national target of about 36 million units of low income housing. Social housing. How are they doing on the move toward that?
Well, there's no doubt that the policy is happening. You know, there was a lot of talk when it was announced that this was all hot air and it wasn't going to happen at all. But there's definitely been a huge push on the social housing program, and actually it was quite useful economically because during the slowdown economically it wasn't a bad way of getting the economy moving.
Right.
I think the 36 million total is kind of exaggerated because it includes all sorts of housing which we wouldn't think of as subsidized social housing. So, for example, it would include sort of housing for kind of for the military. It would include university dormitories. That
it's not actually standalone. own
that's
bath,
right.
Own,
but it's, kitchen, I mean, it, right. The point is, I mean, the numbers aren't very clear. I mean, we estimate at GK Dragonomics, where I work, that a more realistic number is probably about 20 million units. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, they've got a fair chance of meeting that. We don't know because, you know, the other target is for 2015. But they're certainly on track to build a lot of social housing. The problem is that this housing is, as you say, it's aimed at the urban working class, so mm-hmm. native urbanites. It's not really aimed yet at migrant workers.
And absorbing these
yeah,
rural,
I mean, there are, you know, I mean, there are exceptions. So, for example, in say Chongqing, there are. You know, some long-term migrants there have moved into social housing, but
are you talking about People's Heart Park? This is
well, that's, you know, that's, I mean, that was one of the first social housing complexes that opened. So yes, I mean, that's one example.
While we're on the subject of Chongqing, I mean, Chongqing is a really interesting case, of course. I mean, given the controversy that surrounded it with Bo Xilai, but you talk about it as though it was actually. You know, a relative success in a lot of ways. Is there a danger of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, with the Bo Xilai bathwater, as it were? Can you talk a little bit about what that baby might be? What is that baby that ought not be thrown out?
Yeah.
What's Chongqing getting right?
Well, Chongqing and Chengdu actually were in late 2007. They were picked as pilot projects to try to narrow the gap between people in the countryside and people in the city. Mm-hmm. And as a part of that, they've been introducing all sorts of land reforms. A slightly separate question, but it's kind of related to this. But also within the city too, they have a policy of giving hukou to rural migrants. So, you know, and these you know, they have very ambitious targets. So, for example, if you look at Chengdu, Chengdu within the municipal area, which includes the rural area surrounding the kind of city proper,
7 million people.
Yeah, it's about 14 million, actually, but in the city proper, it's 7 million people. Oh. But they want to convert 1 million rural citizens into urban residents over the next. I think it's by 2017 is the target. And then if you look at Chongqing, it's even more ambitious. So in 2010, within the entire municipality, which is the same size as Scotland, it's probably better to call it a city province.
Yeah.
There were roughly 10 million people living in cities, so roughly sort of 6 million in Chongqing, and then another 3 or 4 million places like Fuling, Wanzhou, other cities within Chongqing. But the target is to double the number of people living that kind of urban life by 2020. Now, this is very ambitious, and some of the ways they're trying to do this, you know, I think there will be problems. But you know, they are pilot projects, and China has to be experimental because it has to come up with a kind of solution to this to this problem. And so, you know, Bo Xilai wasn't really responsible for any of these policies himself.
It's 07.
In fact, Huang Qifan, who's the mayor of Chongqing, is actually really the brains, I think, behind this. But you know, so there is a danger that because a lot of these policies have become associated with Bo, that you know, as you say, they might be thrown out. I think though it's actually unlikely.
Oh, good.
Because you know, these reforms started before Bo. They have enormous central support. You know, Chongqing is a central municipality. You know, it's under the control of the central government. And actually, since Bo left, the central government has ploughed even more funds into Chongqing. So, I think there's quite a high chance of these reforms continuing. But I don't want to kind of give the impression that these reforms are perfect, because there have been certainly abuses associated with them.
Right.
But I mean, if you don't try, then it's hard to know, you know, what does work and what doesn't.
Tom, can we pull back a bit from like policy and hukou reform and try to look at, I mean, whether they reform the hukou or not, urbanization is a reality, and you continue to have millions and millions of rural residents moving to the cities. What is China going to look like in 10 years' time in this condition? Who's going to be farming? What's going to happen in the countryside? And are the cities going to be nightmare megalopolises?
Well, this is the big question, and you say that you don't want to talk about policy. It sounds boring, policy, but actually this is all about policy. And, you know, if China doesn't change its current hukou policy, then yes, I mean, that kind of nightmare scenario that you talk about That's much more likely. You say 10 years, I think, you know, in 20 years time, yeah, sure, if there isn't a change, then sort of one in two people living in China cities could be living there without access to, you know, social security and urban rights, right. Education. So that would be, you know, 500 million people. And, you know, socially and therefore politically, that could be disastrous. You know, I mean, that's political dynamite, I think, potentially.
Before you go to politics, yeah. We get a picture of, like, ten years' time, what is China going to look like?
Yeah. Okay.
You
know, okay.
Why don't we just let Tom continue on?
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
What I suspect is going to happen, and you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but from the kinds of comments emanating from Li Keqiang, Jiang Ping, NDRC, so that's the National Development and Reform Commission, which is basically China's state planning body. It looks as though hukou reform is back on the agenda. And, you know, if China's serious about integrating people into urban society, that could begin to make a big difference. So I would hope, to answer your question, that in 10 years' time, we will see a significant number of migrant workers living in subsidized social housing, which will take some of the pressure off China cities. And I would hope that the central government will dip in its pocket to help pay for that, because local governments, frankly, do not have the funds to do that. To go back to your question about what will the land look like then? Well, as more people move off the land, then the size of farms is going to grow. Chongqing is a pretty extreme example, but the average household in Chongqing only farms one third of a hectare. Was it one third?
Third of an acre. Tumu, then, right?
I can't remember. It's one third of an acre, one third of a hectare. But
it's a
tiny parcel of land, and this is deeply inefficient. And actually, you know, it's very, very hard to make a decent living if you're farming a tiny area of land. It would make far more sense for fewer people on the land to farm a larger area, and by doing that, they would have a bigger income. And the people who leave the farm for the city as migrant workers, their income will also increase. But
don't you think it's more likely that agribusiness in combination with government will screw the farmers, and that's who will run the land, and the farmers will have to come to the cities? America.
I think that's a huge danger, and I suspect both will happen in practice. But this is the major fear of the conservative. Of the conservative elements within the government, so you can call them leftists, sort of the people who still believe in a kind of remnant of communist ideology. They look back before the communist revolution, and you know, farmers were basically sort of feudal slaves in their eyes, and they were, and they fear that if there was land reform in the sense that farmers were given private ownership of their land, because currently land is collectively owned, that, you know, many farmers are very uneducated, and they'd be potentially at the...
They'll sell all their land, they'll spend all the money on booze and cars.
Something like that, yes. And then they'll be exploited.
And then the capitalists will exploit them again.
And you'll end up with this massive lump and proletariat in the city. So at the moment, one of the reasons why China's very, very reluctant to let farmers sell their land is that when they move to the city, if anything goes wrong, if there's an economic slowdown, if they lose their job, they have this social, they have this safety net. They can always return to the farm. If they sell their land, particularly for kind of one-off payment, and then they're left bereft after that, then what do they go back to? So, you know, potentially, you know, this is disastrous.
So does this mean that the left not only opposes these sorts of policies in the countryside, but also opposes the other side of the equation, hukou reform, that would make it easier for people to migrate to two cities from the countryside?
Yes, it does, yes.
So that's how the factional schism works, then it's sort of a left-right thing?
Well, this is why all the talk about Bo Xilai being on the left is Chongqing following this very, very leftist model isn't very accurate. You know, there were kind of elements of leftism in what Bo was doing, but actually, when it comes to the land reforms in Chongqing, I mean, in Chongqing, farmers are already mortgaging their land as a part of these experiments. You know, this is absolutely anathema to the party left, and so it is really quite complicated. And actually, the reforms happening in Chongqing, I think, are far more important than the faux Maoist hoopla that surrounded
Red Songs and whatnot. Yeah. Tell us about, one of the things that I found really, really interesting in the book, and this may sound slightly wonkish to people, but I was really interested in the Dipiao system.
Yeah,
the system of
it's kind of complicated.
It is, but I really think that it's worthwhile to take some time and explain it, because this seems like it's quite clever. It's a system of land use credits where you take rural construction land, that is, built land that is sort of zoned for houses and barns and whatnot for structures, and you return it to agricultural land so that you stay above the agricultural red line that was set in order that China still be food self-sufficient. And then you can sell these credits. Developers can, if I'm understanding this correctly, can buy these credits. The money goes to both the village collective and to the actual the person who has given up their rural construction land. And then the developer is able then to acquire land on the periphery of the city. And
that's
build
right.
The
in
next
fact,
damn shopping center.
You've done a very good job, I think, of explaining it, because it is very complex. So to add a little bit of context here, land in China is divided into two. There's rural construction land, which is what you were talking about, and there's farmland.
Mm-hmm.
Only local governments can turn farmland into construction land on which developers can build. The problem is that currently there is a big shortage of farmland in China. There's this thing called the red line, which is the minimum amount of farmland that China thinks it needs to be able to feed itself.
Right.
Each city is given a quota of farmland on which it can build every year. The problem is that quota isn't sufficient. So cities have to find a way of essentially creating new farmland. And this is where a system of land swaps comes in. And so essentially what happens is, as you said, farmers on their homesteads can leave their home, and they can turn the farmland under their home into farmland, and that can then be swapped for rural construction land at the edge of the city. Now, this is happening all over China. Okay, so this isn't just in Chongqing. The difference in Chongqing is that when this happens, it generates a credit. This is the DPR,
right?
A land credit, literally.
Carbon credits, a bit, right?
That's right. It's a sort of security. Now, when this happens, the farmer is given a chunk of money from the government, but then also the credit is then sold on a rural exchange, as it's called, and that allows developers to kind of bid up the price. So then the farmers get some of the income from that DPR, the local government also gets a very, very hefty chunk. For developers to build on land near the city, they first have to buy a DPR, a credit. And so what this does is that it means that farmers who live a long way away from the city can benefit from the urbanization process. So, for example, if I'm a farmer and I'm living in the mountains, say 3 hours from central Chongqing,
I let them bulldoze my house.
Turn it back into farmland. I'll go and live in a new building, sort of maybe on the edge of my village, or maybe in a local town, in kind of consolidated building that takes up much less space. The net gain in farmland is then turned into a credit, a DPR. Then that credit is then sold on this exchange, and developers can buy that, and then they can then buy land on the city edge. They have to have a credit first to be able to do that, and that means that there's no net loss.
So you might simply think of it as the developer actually taking possession of land, of rural construction land on the city edge, but in fact paying a farmer in a distant, more rural locale for his rural construction
land. That's right, yes.
Okay.
But, I mean, this sounds wonderful, but knowing China, usually what happens in this kind of situation is that the farmers get completely screwed, and some unscrupulous developers and unscrupulous officials make money I mean, it's kind of like carbon credits times 10. It's a scam or not. I mean, am I too cynical?
It's a bit of both. No, I mean, you're absolutely right.
I mean, it's open to abuse, at least.
Of course it is. I'm absolutely. I mean, if you believe the Chongqing government, you know, this has created enormous wealth for very, very poor farmers in Chongqing. And I think there's some truth in that. But equally, there have been abuses. There are people who've been out in the field and they've come home to find a digger demolishing their house and they knew nothing about it. And so, of course, there are abuses. And this is always the problem in China. You can have, you know, in theory, the policy is good. The problem is that without checks and balances in the system, it's always open to abuse.
So ultimately, the culprit here is these village collectives, right? These land collectives.
Normally it is, yes, because this is the problem, I think, with the whole notion of collective ownership of land. I mean, originally it was introduced to try to protect individual land owners. I'm sorry.
In fact, it's left, left people vulnerable.
I have to go back there. What was I saying?
Originally it was introduced.
Yeah. Originally, collective ownership was introduced to help protect individual farmers. But the problem now is that because village land can be sold collectively on a collective basis, that means that if you're the village chief, you know, if a developer and a local government come to you and say, "Look, we want, you know, you've got a nice juicy patch of land. We'd like to build a big shopping mall on it," for example.
You have every incentive to f*** the poor farmer, right?
Absolutely. Right. And people are fucked all the time. I mean, this is you know,
this
the
is
biggest
Wukan,
problem.
Right? This is what happened in Wukan, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, in Wukan, you had the village chiefs, and they've been selling off land for years before people rebelled.
This happens everywhere, but Wukan it happened to be a more visible
Well, it happened to be, yes, and partly because I mean, it involved a death.
Right.
And then the villagers, you know, they said that enough was enough, and they revolted. The peasants revolted.
So, land rights reform is one of your big recommendations, and abolition of the village collective system and actual individual land rights.
It's a recommendation, but it has a big caveat.
Okay.
Again, I mean, I think in principle, yes, clearly collective land ownership hasn't worked. And I think Wukan is a good example of that. You know, the fact that, you know, I mean, the numbers are unclear, but 60 million people is one estimate. 60 million farmers have been thrown off their land over the past 10, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were thrown off their land despite the fact, you know, that this land was supposedly collectively owned. And so I think collective ownership doesn't really protect individual interests. And I think, you know, if people actually individually owned their land, then they couldn't be screwed over as easily by the heads of the village. You would have a further advantage in that if you wanted to leave the land, you could then sell it, and you could arrive in the city with money in your pocket. So you wouldn't arrive as a very, very poor migrant. You would arrive as a migrant, you
know, with a little bit of cash in their pocket.
Absolutely, and you know, so China has this. All these dormant assets out there, you can say. So some of the land has a sort of sleeping value, and it can't be realized until land is privatized. The
and
problem
who's
is
the Peruvian economist.
Yeah, Hernando de Soto.
Yeah, de Soto.
He's a big advocate of this. But as Jeremy says, I mean, you know, the big danger if this happens is that people will get screwed over anyway because farmers aren't very educated. You know, they could blow their cash. You know, China doesn't have a sort of political system that would allow, and particularly rule of law is a major issue.
Right.
It doesn't have the kind of infrastructure in place for this to happen fairly. So yes, in theory, this is what should happen, but I don't think it can happen in practice until there are wider political reforms.
One thing we haven't really talked about though is you know. We imagine these village headmen to be these, you know, rapacious kind of evil. But let's look at it from their point of view. Where are they getting their money? They no longer have the agricultural tax, which was abolished in, what was that, 2006, right? They are very dependent on the conversion of land and the sale of land to these developers
not the village chiefs.
Not the village chiefs themselves, but
local
governments.
Local governments are in a very difficult position. You know, local governments all over China sort of run a structural perennial deficit, which doesn't sound, you know, it sounds kind of tedious and kind of economic, but it's very, very important because it means simply that they're short of cash and they've got to find ways of finding cash. And also local governments, you know, they have to provide social welfare and benefits for people, and they're required to do that. And, you know, a very large chunk of income collected locally is sent back to the central government. Okay, some of that comes back as fiscal transfers. But the point is that they really struggle. And so they have to find another way of finding this cash. And land sales is a major way of doing that.
Okay. There's one other topic that you talked about. And this is something we have raised with other guests on the podcast before, including your boss, Arthur. We have talked about the phenomenon of so-called ghost cities. And this is something you address. You talk about the most famous of them in Ordos, Kangbashi, and the Zhengzhou New Town, as well as the new development 20 kilometers south of Yunnan. What's the deal? I mean, you take I guess I could categorize it a very Kroberian take on the ghost cities issue.
I'm not sure I'll speak for Arthur. I think he's taking a more moderate line than I'm used to in the bull bear debate. I think there was a lot of spoken, frankly, about, you know, this whole ghost town or ghost city phenomenon.
Here, Jeremy and I are in agreement too, I think, right?
Yeah.
So, you know,
increasingly few things we agree on.
And I'm saying, you know, and the biggest bullshitter here was, the guy who got the kind of headlines here was this guy called
Jim Chanos,
right? Yeah. So, he's this famous short seller.
He was the Dubai Times street. 10 million guy.
Yeah, he's
right?
That guy. Yeah. I mean, basically, I mean, he said
only 1,000, but
he said that, you know, he said that China was, you know, that it was addicted to, to a land construction was like a heroin addiction, that China was on the treadmill to hell. So he came out and, you know, basically made some pretty silly points. I mean, he was talking through the sort of prism or perspective of an investor, right? So to a certain extent, he was sort of right. Stocks in the kinds of companies that kind of feed off construction in China, you know, they did tank in the last year. But the point is, he made a much, much broader point, saying that ghost towns were kind of evidence that China's entire economy was going, you know, it was going to go to the dogs, which was complete nonsense. And I think a lot of this was kind of built upon a few sort of breathless reports about kind of Ordos, which is, you know, this city in the desert, and then some kind of satellite shots of kind of other new developments, Zhengzhou, as you mentioned, Changgong in Kunming, and a few other places. And the whole notion of ghost city makes it sound as though these are kind of sort of instant cities built in the middle of nowhere and there's no rationale for them. And this is complete nonsense. Kangbashi in Ordos is a little different, but most so-called ghost cities are really suburbs of kind of existing cities which are growing very, very fast. And there's enormous demand for new housing.
I love the way you put it. I think you said something like China's metabolism is fast enough to digest more than a few white elephants. Was that something like that?
Yes. I mean, you know, of course, you know, I'm not saying there isn't waste in the system, and I think Kangbashi in Ordos, you know, it quite possibly. I mean, you know, there it is a local disaster, perhaps, but I mean, frankly, it doesn't matter because Ordos is this crazy place. I mean, you know, it's like a mini Dubai in the desert. Right. Ordos is home to 1/6 of China's coal and coal
Dubai
reserves.
Times 1,000.
Yeah, yeah. But it's, but I mean, if it fails, then I mean, local developers might go bust. Some other people are going to get burnt. It doesn't actually matter. It's not. You can't extrapolate from that to the entire economy.
And waste and a bubble are different things, right?
Absolutely.
There's a lot of waste in China all over the place.
I think the idea
right?
is that, you know, is that in China there is so much waste that it's sign of a bubble. But what these people don't take into account is how fast China cities are growing.
So these people are seduced by metaphors and just don't spend enough time in China, basically.
Yes, but, I mean, these people are clueless. I mean, you know, we're talking about people.
Jim Chanos, clueless.
Jim Chanos, when it comes to China, is clueless.
Clueless.
Clearly, he's a phenomenal investor, but when it comes to China, he's clueless. And he's not the only one. I mean, if you sit at your desk, you know, on Wall Street in the city of London, and you look at China's numbers, then yes, I mean, they do look crazy. But the point is that China is so much bigger than anything else, anywhere else, than anything that's ever happened. It's very, very hard to kind of wrap your brain, I think, around that. And the fact of the matter is that China's cities have been growing by more than 20 million in population every year for the last decade. So that's the size of Australia every year. Now, okay, sure, I mean, a large chunk of that urbanization comes from migrant workers, and they don't have the money at the moment to be able to buy properties. But the point is that most of the demand comes from urban natives who want to live somewhere decent. You know, I mean, it is still a fact that most people in China or live in shitholes, and people kind of forget this. You know, people, sort of analysts, look at the numbers and they say, well, China has all this modern housing, but if they got off their asses and actually went into interior China, they would see this isn't true. And of course, it's not their job to do that. But so it's up to journalists and other people writing about it to kind of explain this to them.
Well, you explained it well. And we really thank you for sharing about this. I really highly recommend anyone to read this book. It's available on Kindle for an exorbitant sum of money. Why is it so goddamn expensive on Kindle?
Well, I don't use Kindle because, as you know, Kaiser, I'm
Paul,
a Luddite.
Paul French, if you're listening to this.
I believe on Kindle it's about £10, $15, which isn't so bad. You know,
I think we should blame Paul French for this.
Yes, Paul
I think we should blame Paul French for a number of things.
Yeah,
but I have to say...
it's
on
Paul
this,
French's short man complex, I think, is responsible for the high price.
Absolutely. Yeah. Tiny man Paul French. I have to say, I mean, Paul's been very helpful to me with this book, so I'm not going to diss him too much tonight.
Okay, just a bit. Yeah. Let's move on to recommendations now for this closing section of the podcast. Tom, you're our guest. Why don't you come first? What do you got here? You've got a nice thick tome here.
That's right. I brought it with me in case I forget the title. My recommendation is a book by a Burmese American called Thant Minh Yu. And his book is called Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. Now, I'm recommending this partly because I'm going to Burma on Saturday morning, which is today is Thursday evening. So that's very, very soon. So I've been reading a lot about Burma and China. But this is a fascinating account of why Burma is of such strategic importance now to both China and India. So he talks about the concept of Burma being China's California. So, you know, China's major disadvantage is that it only has one coast, whereas the US has two coasts. Mm-hmm. I've done this because I'm kind of anal. If you try to measure how far Yangon, Rangoon is from Beijing, it's considerably closer than, say, LA is from DC or from New York.
Huh.
There's this kind of idea in China that if Burma could become some kind of satellite of China, that it could become its California and there'd be access to the Indian Ocean. The problem is that everything has changed in the last 18 months as Burma's opened up, and you know there's a big in Burma there's a big shift away more towards America at the moment. They're trying to counterbalance China's influence. But anyway, this is an interesting book. It's part travelogue. There's some reportage in there. He's much better on Burma than he is on China. He doesn't know much about China, frankly. But it's a good read, and it's also interesting because Burma watchers suspect that this man, Thant Minh Yu, could be president of Burma one day.
Really?
So, you know, there's a good chance that that Aung San Suu Kyi could be the next president. But after that, this guy is essentially Burmese aristocracy. His grandfather was the secretary general of the UN.
Uthant.
That's right. So
thought the name sounded a little familiar.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Jeremy, what do you have for us this week?
I have a very funny little recommendation. It's an app, an iPhone app made by John Biesnecker, who one may, if you're familiar with China blog scene of the last few years, you may know the name.
Of course, John
Biesnecker. He's a coder. And he made this a few years ago. It's called China Plates. And all it is a little app that pulls up the provincial character that is found on various number plates. And so, even if you're an old China hand, you sometimes forget some of the weird characters that are used for provinces that aren't the same as the province. And all this app does is have all of these number plates listed, tell you where they're from, how to pronounce them.
The
one I always forget is Hubei. Hubei has a really funny one, doesn't it?
Hubei is... it's not Xiang. It's... I know it.
It's
Chu, isn't it? Chu.
Is it Hubei?
Should be Chu, yeah.
No, that would be
Hunan is Yu.
Sorry.
That'd be Sichuan, isn't it?
Hubei is Anyway, right, so even such China hands as Tom and Kaiser have forgotten what number plate Hubei has, a very important thing. So
it's a funny character.
You should all go and download. It's called China Plate, and it should be available on the iTunes store, and maybe Android, I'm not sure.
Presumably for free, I hope.
For free,
okay, yeah. Well, good. Thanks, John. Thanks, Jeremy. My recommendations, I want to recommend a couple of Sino-Africa-focused websites. It's been something of a minor obsession of mine recently, just sort of revisiting stuff.
Roots.
Right, that's what it is. First, there's, of course, the China-Africa Project. I think Jeremy in the past has recommended, he used to podcast a lot, this guy named Eric Olander, very, very smart guy, great podcast. He's really slowed down quite a bit on the podcasting, but the site is still terrific. There's an awful lot of information on it. It's really neither sort of uncritically sunny in the Deborah Brodigam kind of vein, or I mean Deborah's book is great. I mean, I highly recommend it, but you know, she does take a very, very optimistic view. Nor is it really negatively biased against China, you know, insisting on framing it in some sort of neo-colonialist narrative. This is a good site that's got a really active Facebook page you should check out. Hopefully they'll be resuming their podcasting soon. The second is actually kind of a splinter cell. It's a blog called Cowries and Rice, written by one Winslow Robertson. The URL is cowriesrice.com. I've not met Winslow. We've actually communicated with him quite a few times on email. He's living in D.C. He spent a lot of his youth in Ghana and in Nigeria. His father was a diplomat. He studied African history as an undergraduate and focused on the history of Sino-African relations when he was doing his graduate work. And he struck out on his own, used to be part of the China-Africa Project. Very interesting post that he did recently. I actually was quoted in it briefly because he asked me to share an anecdote about, I don't know if Jeremy, you weren't around yet, but 88 and 89, in the winter of 88, 89, there were these really unpleasant incidents that took place between African students and Chinese students in Nanjing.
Nanjing riots, famous.
Right. And I you know, sort of...
Kill the black devils.
Exactly.
It's in Pomfret's book, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's in Pomfret's book.
In Chinese Lessons.
Exactly. Chinese Lessons.
So anyway, China and Africa is a topic which we will revisit certainly soon. We have... lines out to some of the experts who may be rolling through town late this spring, and we'll get a fresh batch of experts on the show to talk about this topic. Anyway, thanks, Tom. That was great, man.
Pleasure.
We'll have you on again soon, I hope.
Hope so, too.
Yeah, Jeremy. I wanted to remind everyone, if you didn't catch the very beginning of the show, that we are doing a listener call-in. So call in or, you know, record your questions for us. Like I said, set us a fightin'. It'll be fun. Get Jeremy to rant uncontrollably. It'll be fun. Okay, so we'll see you folks next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care. Bye.